Look, do you remember the 60s, Gladys? I ask the question because sitting in front of me is a gentleman in his 70s who was at the epicentre of the action in the 60s, and he reckons he remembers it. And to make the point, he's about to publish the most extraordinary illustrated memoir with lots and lots of beaut photos and tidbits that prove he was there. It has to be the most, well, the most physically impressive biography I've laid eyes on in many a long time. George Martin, the fifth Beatle. Well, it turns out he produced every one of the Beatles' recordings, played on some of them, wrote scores for movies, Hard Day's Night, Help, Yellow Submarine, and in a career spanning half a century, he's produced a whopping 30 number one hits, and the knighthood was duly bestowed in 1996. I reckon he deserved the knighthood, even if he'd never heard of the Beatles, or if we'd never heard of the Beatles, because he did other terrific things. For example, he wrote a wonderful version of Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood, which I just adore. Did you know Dylan Thomas?
Now, I'm amazed that you know that, actually, Philip. I'm so glad you've mentioned that. Yeah, that's one of my favourite albums. And
but did you know? Did you know the poet? Did you?
I never knew. I never met Dylan.
Never met him. No.
No. I met the Irishman, his equivalent, Brendan Behan.
Brendan Behan. Yeah.
And he was a tearaway too.
But that's only the beginning of it. There's so many other people that I love who you've worked with. An old friend, Peter Ustinov, Spike Milligan, a sort of a quasi-Australian, Peter Sellers, you did Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Alan Bennett, Jonathan Miller, and I had no idea that you're also involved with two people I've just introduced to my 10-year-old daughter, Flanders and Swan.
Oh, yeah. Mike Flanders and Donald Swan. Lovely people. And great wits. And do you ever see the show when it came out?
No, but I've got all the albums. Oh, and right. I've taught Rory to sing Mud, Mud, Glorious Mud, and the whole repertoire.
I'm a Gnu. And another Gnu.
I mean, that is great writing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's great writing. And so even if the Beatles hadn't come along, you've had a great life so far, haven't you?
I can't complain. I really can't.
Yeah.
I had a number one hit long before the Beatles, because I used to do a lot of jazz records too. And I had a hit with a group called the Temperance Seven. The Temperance Seven consisted of nine men who all drank like fishes. And
lovely irony.
Yeah,
lovely
absolutely.
Irony. Yeah.
And they were a great, great band, actually. You're driving me crazy with the title.
I thought your debut was with the Four Tune Tellers.
Oh, now you are digging up the past, aren't you?
Digging up the dirt. Tell us about the Four Tune Tellers.
Well, it was a little band that I ran when I was 15 years old, and I thought it was a terribly clever name, but of course it's absolutely dreadful, isn't it, looking back at it. And this all came to roost when quite a few years ago, they subjected me to This Is Your Life. And I had no idea it was being done to me. And a lot of it was great people on with me, Dudley Moore and Matt Munro and Rolf Harris and people like that.
I should have mentioned Rolf Harris, another with whom you've had an association, somewhat briefer.
But then they bring on these three guys, four guys, and said, "Your band, the Fortune Tellers." And I didn't recognise a single one.
Oh, well, time's winged heels. But I should point out this was a band you formed when you were 16.
That's right.
In 1942.
Yeah.
Which means how old are you now? I can't do the math.
Another 60 years on top of that.
Oh, well, you're going all right, aren't you? Now, the height of World War II. A year later, you're age 17, and you joined the air wing of the Royal Navy, which was the British Fleet Air Arm.
That's right.
Why did you do that?
Well, I didn't want to wait until somebody called me up and put me in the bloody infantry. And I knew I was going to have to do that because the war was still on. And I wanted to fly. I was always mad on airplanes, always. So I went along to the recruiting office when I was 17 and volunteered. I didn't tell my parents. And my mother was distraught when I went back. And she said, "You damn fool, you'll kill yourself." But fortunately, I didn't.
No, you didn't. And the evidence of that is your presence here this evening. You were an observer. What was an observer?
Well, an observer is the guy who sits in the middle of the aircraft and tells what the other guys what to do.
He outranks the pilot, in a sense?
Well, yeah, because it's the old naval tradition that the guy who is the coxswain, who steers the boat, isn't the captain of the boat.
No, of course. I should have realised that.
And if you're in a torpedo bomber, which is what we were on, the pilot did his obeyed orders and the observer gave them. And the air gunner at the back just fought off the other aircraft.
Well, of course, you were helping fight Hitler like Spike Milligan. But did you get any music going when you were in the... serving His Majesty?
Well, we had a good time, actually. I remember getting involved in a pantomime in Trinidad where I was training, and I had to do the music for it. And we actually had an RAF officer on our course, which was most unusual for a naval course. And this guy had been attached in order to learn something about naval flying. And we got him very drunk on the evening of the pantomime. And he had a typical pilot officer prune moustache. We shaved off exactly one half of it. So he had a propeller with one blade missing.
He wouldn't have been too pleased about that.
He was quite annoyed when he woke up.
One of my first memories of a job was a brief employment in the music library of a Melbourne radio station. In fact, I was there the day we tossed out the 78s too, which is, they were hurled. Barry Humphrey's first job was breaking 78 records for for a radio station.
We used to make fruit bowls out of them.
You
melt the shellacs and shape them into fruit bowls.
I mention this because your job after you saved the civilised world from Nazism was that you got a job in the BBC music library.
Yep, that's right. Sorting out scores, it was useful for me to study scores, to be honest, when I was there, but it was a very boring job. It lasted 3 months, and I took it, really, to keep the wolf from the door. I was playing the oboe in the evenings with the Sadler's Wells Orchestra and other places, and it was an extra bit of money, a day job, if you like.
Well, something else happened there because you met your wife, who I've just met, and you've been married ever since.
Well, in fact, it's a bit of a different story. There were two ladies involved, and that was my first wife.
Oh, right. I shall have a researcher whipped. Okay. Well,
present wife's listening. She'll be enjoying that.
Yeah. Well, I found it extraordinary to think that, this could possibly have endured since 19...
We've endured a long time, nevertheless.
Oh, well, congratulations. Now, I mentioned all those comedy records, those extraordinary affiliations you had with comical people. Why was that? Were you as drawn to comedy as you were to music?
Well, yes and no. I was 24 when I joined EMI, and I took it as a stopgap job, but I got hooked. I thought the world of Abbey Road was like a gigantic toy shop for me, and I loved it. And I was obviously quite good at it. I started doing classical records, but my boss piled on all sorts of other stuff, jazz, light orchestral, folk music, children's records, everything that he wanted to get rid of, he gave me. Good training. And after 4 years, he retired, and I wasn't looking forward to this because I knew some idiot would be put in over me. And you could have knocked me down with a sledgehammer when they told me that I was going to get his job. And at 29, I was head of Parlophone Records.
We're talking about a major operation, aren't we? Parlophone was a substantial enterprise.
Well, Parlophone was a very small label then.
Was it?
Oh, absolutely.
Because when I think back to childhood, I can see Parlophone
it was a rhythm label. It was a jazz label. Had no big hits. Had no big artists. And we had people like your Graham Bell and his Dixieland Jazz Band, Freddie Randall, Humphrey Littleton, Johnny Dankworth, and...
What are you talking about? No big names. These are sacred, the ones you're reeling.
Well, thank you, but I meant people like Sinatra and Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
So I had to make the label work, and I had to make it pay, and I had to think of something which didn't require a Frank Sinatra. So I thought I'd make some comedy records, and everybody thought I was mad.
There was a tradition of British comedy recordings, like there was a tradition of British postcards.
Yes.
And I remember as a child listening to radio programs with English comedy. This is long before your stuff. There were Cicely Courtney and Laughing Gas.
Wasn't that a good record?
Wonderful record.
Lovely record. Yeah.
That era. So yeah. There was precedent, wasn't there, to what you did with, say, Ustinov and Sellers?
Oh, yes. I wasn't the first to do it. There was The Laughing Policeman.
Yes.
And anything that made you giggle. But I don't think it would work now, because radio in those days was the only thing we had, and people had wonderful imaginations. So that if you created a really good sound that people could imagine, shut their eyes and imagine.
But that's why wireless is such a sophisticated medium. It doesn't pre-imagine. You've got to do the work, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
It's the best there is.
Where television, the banalities of many feature films, is they do all that work and you're just...
You're passive. Yeah, but the shame is that young people are growing up to see more and hear less. You know, they're conditioned by the television screen and the computer screen. And their little text messages on their mobiles, they keep looking. They don't keep listening.
Now, you're used to people genuflecting in your presence because of the Beatles. I genuflect because you worked with the Goons, and I didn't know this. What did you do?
Well, I started off with Peter Sellers because I was looking for somebody. Peter at that time was a stooge in Raise a Laugh with Ted Ray. But he had this great facility for voices, which I wanted. And in fact, I was making a children's record, and that's why I picked on him, first of all. Then I saw the possibilities of what we could do together and suggested we made some records, and he loved the idea. And through him, I met Spike, became very, very fond of Spike. We made lots of records together. Not many of Spike's records sold, but Peter's did. But we had enormous fun, and Spike became godfather to my son, and I was best man at his second wedding. And he was a lovely man.
Tell us the story you told me off air
about the
sad attempt of Spike to contact you just
before
he died.
Yeah. Spike always rang me, and or I rang him from time to time. We lived a long way apart, so we didn't meet yet. We met up in town sometimes. But about 6 months before he died, he rang me at home in my home in the country, which is in Wiltshire. And I wasn't there. I was in London. He didn't know this. And he spoke to my chap, John. John had no idea who was ringing, and Spike said, "Well, can I speak to George Martin, please?" And John said, "Who's speaking?" And he said, "You are." Which, of course, was completely logical.
Yeah, it's like Zen, isn't it, or something? It's a fabulous line. And, of course, I drive up and down huge distances between here and where I live. And they on the way back now, I listen to the Goons, and it's as fresh as ever. It's amazing, isn't it, how little it's really worn or dated.
Well, Spike and I used to have good lunches together, and one day we had lunch in a Bertarelli's restaurant, an Italian restaurant. Quite liquid it was, and we came out feeling quite good. And right next door was a funeral director, William Nodes. Spike spotted this, quickly dived into the door, and of course there was no one there, and there never is in these places. And spotted a piece of purple cloth, lay down on the floor, pulled it over him, and shouted, "Shop!"
I've just been given a prompt. I've got to ask you about the first Sellers record, Jacker, a disaster. Why?
Well, I'd like to say it was before its time, but I think it was long after. It was just terrible. When I look back in it, I'm ashamed. But Peter lent into the spirit of it. I mean, I got him doing Churchill's voice as God. You know, Jacker was a space story of a kid with a three-legged dog who wandered through space on a scooter. And it was a story with songs, and it was a children's story, but it didn't work. But fortunately, Peter did, and we made some good records after that.
You worked with Beyond the Fringe, Bennett, Cook, Moore, Jonathan Miller. Did you do those ultra X-rated records?
The which ones?
The really naughty records that Pete and Dud did.
Oh, no, I didn't, actually, although I knew about them. Oh, they were naughty, weren't they?
Very naughty, yes.
No, that was after the Fringe lot, but we did do the famous...
I was going to have to terminate the interview if you'd done those, because this is a family program, so I'm delighted that you were
modesty stopped me doing it, of course.
Right. Okay, now the B words. How did you... come into their orbit, or alternatively, how do they come into yours?
Who's?
The Beatles.
The Beatles?
You've heard of them.
Oh, I wondered about them. Yeah. Oh, God, I'm sure everyone knows this story.
No, they don't. I don't.
Don't you?
No idea.
Well, I was looking for something.
I know about Under Milkwood. I don't know about this.
Yes, well, let's talk about Under Milkwood.
We'll after.
No, I was looking for a new sound or a new artist. And everybody knew that. I put the word around. I said, look, I've got to find somebody who's going to sell records. And there was a music publisher who worked for EMI. And one day he met up with Brian Epstein. And Brian played him these tapes. To cut a long story short, he arranged for Brian to come and see me with these tapes. And I listened to them. And they were terrible. And I said to Brian, look, if you want me to judge the group on this sound, then the answer's no. And he looked so crestfallen. I said, but if you want to bring them down, I'll give them an hour in the studio, see if there's anything there. Well, he did that. And they came to the studio. And they were delightful. I fell in love with them.
But it was the personality more than the performance.
Absolutely, absolutely. They had
that this, vivacity.
They had tremendous charisma. They made me feel good to be with them. And I thought, okay, if they have that feeling on, they do that to me, then they'll do that to an audience.
See, one of the strange things about you, and you know, I've seen 1,000 images of you over the years, is you look incredibly straight, don't you? You know, you're very dignified.
Am I?
Yes, you are, George. I hate to tell you this. And yet your whole career has been dealing with rat bags. Do you find it easy to deal with the creatively eccentric?
I never think of this, you know. I really don't. I mean, they're all people to me, and they're I get on very well with them, whoever they are, whether they're rat bags, as you say. I haven't met many rat bags.
It's not a pejorative term. It's a term of distinction in Australia, rat bag.
Well, they're not all that primitive. I mean, when you think of John and Paul, they and I had much the same background. I mean, I started a band when I was 15.
True.
And they started a band when they were 15.
Yeah.
I wasn't taught music when I was a kid. I learned it later.
So you're sort of auto or audio didacts in that sense.
Well, and I went to the same kind of school. I went to a state school and I won a scholarship, and they did the same kind of thing. My father was a carpenter, so I wasn't a knob.
No. Was the relationship that, however, of a teacher to pupils, or was it more camaraderie?
Well, to begin with, of course, I had to tell them how to look at a microphone and how to handle it.
I must say, listener, when he walked in, he grabbed the microphone in a very authoritative way and fiddled with it. I recognised you'd seen them before.
Yeah, they have been involved. I have been involved with them.
Are they as much a musical instrument as anything else for you? I mean, the microphone placement, the subtleties that you can get at it.
Well, I'm not an engineer, but microphones are pretty important, and you have special microphones for different things. But I did have an engineer that I picked out of the blue called Jeff Emmerich, and I gave him his big job when he was 18. And he loved experimenting, and he used to put microphones so near the bass drum that they used to break them. And his boss didn't think much of that at all, and he once experimented a microphone inside a glass of water. Of course, it didn't do anything, but he was trying out different sounds.
But that was a time of a lot of invention, where people would create an echo chamber by, you know, routing a sound through the toilet, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah, our echo chamber was full of drain pipes.
Right.
And that was the way you had it, that things. But you flew by the seat of your pants in those days. And I found out how to turn tapes back to front and to make a piano sound funny by treating it with bits of drawing pins or newspaper.
Was it more creative, do you think, than a world which is inundated with, digital technology?
Well, you had to do it for yourself. You couldn't press a switch and get it. If I wanted the noise of a... Well, for example, and when I did the thing with Spike Milligan called A Bridge on the River Kwai, do you remember that album?
Absolutely.
That was originally Bridge on the River Kwai, but David Lean threatened to sue us if we should.
No sense of humour, David Lean. No.
And I had to cut off every K with a pair of scissors.
You're not serious.
Really, I really did. I cut off 124 Ks.
And spliced all those little bits of tape.
So everybody said, oh, the river, why is it?
I hope David Lean was appreciative.
Yeah, well, we got the record out anyway.
So how powerful were you as the producer? Did you make the final big decisions on the subtleties of a recording, or was it a collective decision? Or?
Well, I certainly made the decisions in the early days, but of course as the Beatles became enormously successful and enormously knowledgeable too. I mean, we were together for 8 years, so by the time we finished, they knew more about recording than I did. And it was, in the end, it was a real good partnership of five people. We all had a voice, and it worked very well. We were good friends, and we all contributed.
Mm. I do want to talk about To Begin at the Beginning. Slow black, grey back, fishing boat, bobbing sea. Yeah. How did you get involved with Under Milkwood?
Well, there was only one recording. Actually, no, I lie. There were two originally. There was one by Dylan Thomas himself, which he did in a kind of with a Grundig recorder in New York YMCA.
He had a great voice, though, didn't he?
With three other people. It wasn't a very good technical recording. And then there was the famous one with Richard Burton.
Yeah.
And Richard Burton did that in 3 days. And what a brilliant job he did. But it was 1953, and it was mono. And I thought we should make a modern version in stereo, with sound effects, with new music, and so on. And so I got hold of Anthony Hopkins, and he loved the idea, and got together all the Welsh taffia. And I remember Freddie Jones coming in the first day of recording and seeing all the array of Welsh stars we had there. Every famous Welsh person you could think of, Sean Phillips and Harry Secombe and Tom Jones.
Was Harry Welsh?
Harry Secombe was very, my goodness.
Is that right?
Very Welsh.
Oh dear, I didn't know that.
And and when Freddie Jones saw this collection, he tossed his hat in the air and he said, "Good God, Wales must be closed today."
You were surprised that I liked it and sort of knew about it. Did it sort of not make much of a ripple?
Well, it sold fairly well, but not, I mean, obviously it wasn't the greatest seller in the world, but it was still a lovely recording, and I think you can still get it. We actually did a live performance of it 10 years ago when I opened a new studio, one that I designed, and I asked Prince Charles to come along.
Well, he's got a Welsh connection, hasn't he? He's the Prince of Wales.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And the girl who sings Polly Garter, who in the original wasn't available, that was Bonnie Tyler. I had to find another Polly Garter for my live performance. And I got a young Welsh girl who was very pretty and sang extraordinarily well. Her name was Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Oh, really? Yeah. You old star-spotter,
you. I know.
Dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Yes, Tom, Dick and Harry with three fine men, and I'll never have such loving again. It was great lyrics. He was a good lyricist, wasn't he?
Yeah. Dylan Thomas. Do you know I got who to set that particular one?
No.
Elton John.
Oh, right.
And I stood over him while he did it.
Literally or metaphorically?
Literally.
Right.
Because I kept asking him. I said, "Are you going to do this, Elton?" He said, "Look, come round to my place next Monday at 11 and we'll do it." And I stood over him until he actually finished it.
Well, of course, you and Elton then had a reprise, didn't you, together? You did, you worked with him on Candle in the Wind, on that tribute to...
That's right, which was...
Princess Di.
It was a tragic occasion, but it was... I was worried about it, but when I saw him at the Westminster Abbey, and I realised it was okay, and he came on from the Abbey an hour later after the funeral service, and we sat down in the studio together, and I put him down, and we finished the recording that night, and it was on sale within a couple of days, and sold 33 million records, and made about £10 million for the charity.
That'd be the biggest single seller, would it?
Biggest ever.
Yeah, ever.
Yeah,
in history.
Ever. And my last single, too, my last number one.
When we talk about biggest sellers ever, do we take into account some of these extraordinary Middle Eastern performers, you know, like a famous Egyptian singer whose name escapes me, or do we take into account the Chinese market for Chinese stars?
Well, I've never examined the Chinese market closely.
But you know what I'm saying, don't you? People talk about
saying.
The Titanic as the most expensive film ever made. It wouldn't have cost half of what Sergei Bondarchuk's War and Peace cost because it had the entire Red Army in it.
Absolutely. On the other hand, I do know that the record market in China is very small. And the people
except all the pirated versions of your...
except for ours, yeah.
Yes, your albums, Now, not everything worked like a charm. For example, Sergeant Pepper, stellar cast, soundtrack sold its pants off, but the film, as I understand it, was less than a blockbuster.
Yeah, the film was a bomb.
Oh, really? Bad as that, yeah.
Yeah, it really was. Well, in fact, I didn't quite know what I was getting into, but Jim Dale was an old friend of mine. In fact, I had a hit with him in the early days, and he's now a big Broadway star. He was the original Barnum. And he saw the stage version of Sergeant Pepper, and he raved about it on Broadway.
Right.
And he said, it's a great show. And when I heard that it was being made into a film, and I was asked to do the musical direction, I wasn't sure about it, but my wife said, well, if you don't do it, somebody else will, and they won't do it as well as you, so you better do it. So I did it, so I can blame her, can't I?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mentioned the beginning of the 60s and the old thing about if you remember it, you weren't really there. Just between you and I, and I'll turn the microphones off, did you ever get into the old recreational narcotics when you were beetling?
Absolutely not.
Never?
Never.
Not even tempted?
Oh, well, I must confess, I did actually draw on one once to find out what it was like. And it did nothing for me, so I left it.
Richard Neville gave me very strange cigarettes to smoke once in London, and they didn't do anything for me either, and I gave up with great disappointment.
Right, there you go. We're two birds of a feather.
What's wrong with us?
Well, I think we're right, actually, because I think those guys... I mean, I don't think there's much wrong with pot, to be honest.
Don't you?
Well,
no,
let them have it if they want
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Probably just no worse than smoking ordinary cigarettes,
no.
Which is bad enough. But I think the other stuff is dreadful and it's a killer.
Well, you must have seen a lot of people die of their own hand in that sense during that era.
I've worked with some great jazz musicians who've died of heroin.
Mm.
There was a guy called Tubby Hayes, one of the best sax players we ever had in London. There was a great drummer by the name of Phil Seaman. These guys destroyed themselves, and it was tragic to see.
What about the flip side of that, the old argument, that the romanticising of drugs argument, that Charlie Parker would never have played like that if he hadn't been an addict?
Well, I it's a tenuous argument, that. I mean, you can say it. I mean, there's no way of saying, well, what if he hadn't done it, what would he have been any good? Because he didn't, you know, because he did it. It's like saying, what would have happened if Hitler hadn't invaded Poland? You know, you don't. There was always that big if. I don't think the Beatles would have produced any inferior jobs on Sergeant Pepper, for example, if they hadn't been on drugs.
Did you ever have trouble with them when they were a bit high and you were trying to get a performance out of them?
They were always very sweet. They knew I disapproved, and they never did it in front of me.
I come back to this straight. I mean, you could pass for an Anglican bishop.
Well,
you know that, don't you?
Oh, God.
No, you could. Everyone, look, they're all nodding out there. They all agree.
But they used to, they never used to smoke when we were on the job. But they, once a song was finished, one of them would nip down to the canteen and have a little drag, come back into the control room with a seraphic smile on their face, you know. And I knew exactly what had happened. And there was no harm in that at all. But the other stuff, once John got into other gear, it became a different person.
One of the things about your life, we talk about the 60s, but the British 60s and the US 60s were fundamentally different. The great thing was that you were in London at a time when Britain suddenly creatively asserted itself after a long period of self-doubt.
Yeah.
And suddenly the world knew about Britain. It was cool to be British as opposed to being rather boring, really.
I think timing is everything, and you don't always choose your own timing. God probably chooses it for you. There's the Anglican bishop speaking.
Yes.
And for example, you know, when I was in the Fleet Air Arm, that we were just ready to go on a carrier. We were en route to the Pacific to fight in Japan when they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. And that was good timing. And it was pretty good timing when we launched the Beatles, because it was the time when Mary Quant, Carnaby Street, Britain was throwing over the shackles of the greyness after the war, and all the young people wanted to assert themselves, and they had the voice of assertion in the form of the Beatles.
Yes, who quite cleverly had hybridised American cultural influence and made it into something of their own.
The Beatles used to listen to the best of rock and roll of Britain that America could give them, especially Motown stuff. And they worked on it and re-exported it back to them.
But there was no precedent for, as far as I know, for say, a song like Eleanor Rigby. That's not a hybrid song. That's totally and utterly original. When I first heard that, I was just gobsmacked. It seemed to me it was a work of literature.
You're right. I mean, they did develop, their songwriting blossomed, and they never gave me the same thing twice. They always gave me something fresh, and I was always grateful for that.
But isn't that interesting? Because it goes against what most artists do. A visual artist tends to paint variations on a theme. Every artist identifies themselves with a bit of turf, a piece of territory, and their audience becomes comfortable with them. And if they move outside that, they're often into deep trouble. Your lads, the Beatles, constantly dragged their audience, kicking and struggling with them, somewhere else.
That's right. And because they had this intense curiosity to see what was beyond the horizon, what people couldn't see for themselves, they wanted to reach out and get things that, you know, even up to the time he died, I don't think John was ever really satisfied with what we did. I was with him not long before he went, and I had dinner with him one night, and we chatted about old times, and he said, "I'd love to record everything again." And I said, "John, you can't mean that." I mean, that filled me with horror, the idea of going through all that again. I said, what about Strawberry Fields? He said, "Oh, especially Strawberry Fields."
Is that right?
And for him, in his mind, there was a wonderful, wonderful heaven of sounds that he never really achieved. And I don't think he ever would have achieved. Maybe he's got it now. But the reality was never within his grasp.
This is an interesting notion, isn't it? Going back and doing things over and over again. A vaudeville star might have one or two songs that had made him famous. Yeah. I Belong to Glasgow, and they just sing that a million times. Tom Jones and others have got signature songs.
That's right.
And one's career must get a bit dull as a consequence. But you've been involved with people who were to some extent reckless.
That's true. Mark Hugh, they still had to bring up their signature tunes sometimes. I mean, Paul does his tour. He's coming here in November, I gather. I saw his show in Dallas. It's a great show. Go and see it. But he still has to sing Yesterday because everybody wants him to.
Mm.
And Here, There and Everywhere. You know, the pop ones.
Mm, but a courageous artist plays with it, does variations, fiddles around.
That's right.
Like Bach.
Yep.
The variations, yeah. I suppose one of the dilemmas for you, let me rephrase that. One of the reasons I bet you did Milkwood was to show that you bloody well could do things totally and utterly autonomously.
Oh, gosh, that's a big subject, isn't it? Yeah. I think you're probably right. I really did Under Milkwood because I loved the poetry of it.
Absolutely, and that shows, but it's nonetheless important for an artist to say, this is me, as opposed to, this is the fifth Beatle.
You mean that I was seeking my own fame on that
one? Yeah, no, your own identity. You're famous anyway, okay. For God's sake. In fact, you're so famous, I better mention who you are. This is Late Night Live on Radio National, and I'm talking to Sir George Martin. Now, I can remember talking to Putnam now, Lord Putnam now, isn't he? After he made Local Hero. And I said, you made Local Hero as an expiation of guilt for having made Chariots of Fire. You've got to keep chopping and changing, but it's not, you don't want to go down in history simply as the guy that did the Beatles records.
But you get labelled with whatever you do. You know, before the Beatles came along, I had a label, and the label, I was the comedian's producer.
Yeah.
And I got another one then, after when the Beatles. And I've had other ones too, but not quite so enduring as the Beatles ones, because they happen to be the biggest of all time.
Of course, but I bet you wear the comedian's producer as proudly. I mean, that's no bad thing. What a gift those people gave to us, the comedians you worked with.
Yeah.
Milligan made the Cold War tolerable, for heaven's sake. I mean, he was as great an absurdist as Samuel Beckett.
Yeah, they were such fun people to work with, you know, and it was a creative time. Doing things like, one of my favourite tracks of Peter Sellers was the one which he did with Irene Handel called Shadows in the Grass.
Yeah.
Well, that was just an ad-lib thing, and we added sound effects of feet on gravel and birds in the trees, the distant hum of traffic. So you could hear yourself. You could hear that they were in the park. And they just ad-libbed for about 15 minutes, and I edited it down to about 6. And it was a nice little piece. But she was such a lovely, lovely actress, and she was very good at that kind of thing.
She was my first job as a young journalist, was to interview Irene Handel.
Really?
God, that was, 40, 50 years ago. Okay. And I loved her. And she wrote a bloody good novel called The Sioux.
Didn't she? Yeah, absolutely.
A very impressive piece of writing.
An extraordinary woman. She used to bring cakes in to the engineers when we made a recording, But she didn't become an actress until she was in her 40s.
Well, she made up for it, because she was bloody good. There was a depth to a Handel performance.
She certainly did.
Look, the one connection between all the things you've done, the comedy and the Beatles, Irene Handel, is that these people celebrate life. There's a subtext in much popular culture which is self-pitying, depressing. But the Beatles were always life celebrators, and so was Spike, and so was Ustinov, and so was Sellers. They were happy to be alive. They thought it was a privilege.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and I think that is. I think also the ability to make people laugh, or make people happy because they hear a good song, is one of the best abilities you can ever have. I think, and music is that wonderful art that can give such pleasure to people.
Well, the thing that makes music trickier, and some of the best Beatles songs show it so vividly, is you can have contrapuntal moods. You can be happy and sad at once.
Yeah.
In music,
you played "Hard Day's Night" by Scoldy Horn to begin with. Yeah. She's a delightful character. We had great fun doing that, but that was the third time I recorded that piece. The first time was with the Beatles. The second time was with Peter Sellers. You didn't hear that?
He does it.
We did a series of recordings.
He talks it, doesn't he?
Yeah, we did a series of recordings where he talked the lyrics.
That's right.
And on that particular one, he took the voice of Laurence Olivier in the part of Richard III. And I put in a kind of medieval backing. And it was one of my favourite tracks. A nice one, that.
We're talking about juxtapositions. He was a guy who was one of the funniest people ever, but also a deeply melancholic and driven man, wasn't he?
He was a very sad man in the end. Yeah. Success was not good to him in that respect.
In what sense?
Well, he became too famous and fell in love with it, almost. And Spike was a much happier person, a much warmer person than Peter. Peter hardly had an identity of his own. He was
right.
Fine.
Yes, if he was reading a part, the lights were on, but Spike knew who he was.
That's right.
At all the time, didn't
all
he?
All the time.
Yeah. But do you agree that a lot of popular culture, particularly popular music, has got this misanthropic feeling of a deep sort of pessimism and bleakness? And not that that's, one can forgive youngsters feeling that.
You're talking about music we have today, are you?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
You don't like it, do you?
Not a lot, no.
No.
But I like that stuff you did with those four fellas. I thought that was great.
That's old stuff, though. Yeah. It's 40 years ago. I think there is a kind of death wish, if you like, amongst a lot of music we get nowadays. But that's what young people like. They like heavy noises, and they like things they can see, too. They like their records to be performed by beautiful young people who move well.
And yet here was you, here were you and your generation surviving a war, and you came out of it determined to rejoice, determined to be happy.
Well, it's much better than what we had before. If you have a very grey time, then the only thing to do is to try and make it better. If you have a great time all the time, then there's nowhere up to go, is there?
Are you sad now when you think back that two of them are gone already? Does this sort of get to you?
Well, of course. I mean, John and George should never have died. George in particular, because it was awful, really. The attack on George, I'm sure, contributed to his eventual death. And John, that was lunacy, wasn't it? Mm. Anyone killing anybody like that.
But there was, of course, a messianic quality in John. And there's nothing like the messianic sort of phenomenon to draw out that sort of destiny.
Oh, I don't know. I think it's easy to talk about people who have been assassinated in that way rather than if Paul had gone that way, you would say the same thing.
No, I don't think I would. I think that, it was it John that talked about being as famous as Jesus, which is absolutely true, but a fairly dangerous and provocative thing to say at the time.
John talked about it. You think about the Jesus bit,
don't you? Yeah.
That had nothing to do. What he really meant there, he got himself into terrible hot water. I mean, he got people burning records all over the place. Now, what he really meant was, and it was quite factual, that people don't go to church anymore. And saying, our records sell so many, we're more popular than Jesus.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that was true.
Well, there was a survey done in Australia, and I think it was also done in the UK. And for kids, the golden arches sign of McDonald's is more significant and more meaningful than the crucifix. They know what that is.
Yeah.
The McDonald's sign, they're not sure about that thing on the top of your church, Archbishop.
Well, it's a shame, but we have a church in our village which is still active, which is fortunate. But it is a fact, I'm afraid, that in England, more people go to a Muslim mosque than Christians go to a church on a Sunday.
I should mention this extraordinary book of yours. It's called Playback the Memoir. It's in a very limited set. And it can only be purchased at a website. Now, grab your lippy listener and write this on the bathroom mirror. The website is www.playback.com.au. www.playback.com.au. It's a very impressive tome. As I said, it's quite splendiferous. It'll set you back $880, which sounds a lot, but look, think of it as an investment. It can become a family heirloom to pass on to the great-grandchildren. And why did you choose this form of publication? That's very esoteric of you.
I was intrigued by I've had three other books out, and this obviously isn't going to be my final one. And the guy who suggested it to me said, you might want to do this. George Harrison had done it with I, Me, Mine, and Ravi Shankar had a book like that.
Right.
And it's beautifully done. And I thought, well, if I'm going to have an autobiography, I'd like to have it in this form where there's lovely photographs, where it's a book that you really value.
Like the Richard Avedon one. Did you see that a couple of years ago?
Yes, absolutely.
Superb book. Yeah.
Well, there's only 2,000 of this.
And they won't finish up on the remainder table, will they?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that they're obviously going to be selling a lot, even though they are very expensive. And I think they'll go up in value too.
Later, will there be sort of a scruffier sort of paperback downmarket version?
Apparently, at the moment, there are no plans for it.
Okay. Look, it's been a pleasure and a privilege, Sir George, and I'm sorry I got the wives mixed up. Would you apologise to Lady Martin for me?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm very naughty, and I stand in the corner and smack my bottom. Look, thanks for that. This is, that's a wrap.